Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. Later on in the program, Bobby Valentine and Doug Heller will be talking about their new book, Aloft, at the Albuquerque International Balloon Fiesta. I'm delighted to welcome to the program Tonya Hessen-Shea. She is director of the award-winning documentary Play Again, which screens in Santa Fe this Wednesday, the 17th of August at 7 in the evening at Warehouse 21, co-presented by Bioneers. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much.
So this is a film about a group of young people, Americans, teenagers, who are basically all, I don't know if you can call it addicted, but they are all basically, let's call it addicted to their screens, their computers, their cell phones, their games. And these kids are basically taken into the wilderness without any of that stuff and learn how to actually be with nature. How did you get the idea to do this film?
Well, the background of the film started many years ago when I came across this study that showed that children today, down until, you know, the 3 years of age, could recognize hundreds of corporate logos while they only could name, you know, 10 plants in their own backyards. And to me, this really shows how serious the situation of today has become, where children are growing up inside, in front of their screens, in the virtual reality, and not barely spending any time outside. And I grew up in Norway, and how I was raising my children here in the States was just so different than how my upbringing was in Norway, and it was just really concerning to me where we're headed right now.
It is quite amazing, because you show some of that footage in the film of these little, tiny, sweet children who know a Target logo, but they don't know what a dandelion is.
Yes. It is, children today are spending up to 90% of their time indoors. So they're, you know, I would say many of the people we've talked to say that children today are growing up in a virtual house arrest. And that is something that we really got to take seriously, because it affects their health and well-being, as well as our society overall. And also, if you think about it, if we're raising children today in a time when we really need to be connected to nature, to realize what kind of challenges we're facing as far as the environment, and how are they going to be able to deal with these challenges if they don't even know what nature is, or don't have a connection to the natural world.
The term that you just used, virtual house arrest, I mean, house arrest is a terrible punishment, but for these kids, it's almost like they don't even want to go outside.
Well, I think, you know, if that's how you grow up, our children are always supervised today. Roaming has pretty much disappeared from our children's vocabulary. Barely do you see children just biking outside or walking alone or walking to school even.
Which is so different from my generation, which really isn't all that long ago, or probably the way it still is in Norway.
Yeah, things are changing on a global spectrum. This is not just a U.S. issue. Since we released the film a year ago, we're seeing how this is really resonating with an international audience from Australia, Brazil, Canada. So it's really a global problem that we're facing right now. But, you know, children, to be outside, you kind of got to almost learn how to be outside and how to play. And they are so used to the virtual world. And also parents are afraid today to let the children outside. And it's interesting if you look at the statistics of child abductions today and from when we were growing up and freely roaming outside, the numbers have really not changed. What has changed is the media and how they're focusing on the fare of the few cases that you know, happen.
So there's no more child abductions now than there ever were.
No, but it's the sensationalism and the fear-mongering, I believe, that we're seeing in the media today that is causing a lot of unnecessary fear. And I don't think that people should just let their kids out right away and start roaming. I do think that we have to change things in society. We have to look at city planning. We have to look at our neighborhoods and parks and make safe walkways and bikeways and there is a lot of work that needs to happen before we can just let our children roam freely. But there's, you know, it's a serious issue that we have to look at and start doing something about.
Now, the kids in the film play again, these teenagers, some of these children were facing screens, looking at screens, interacting with screens 15 hours a day.
Mm-hmm.
That's almost, how is that possible?
I also wanted to say something because the it was very important to us when we made this film to find children or teenagers that could represent the average American child. And today, there's a study that shows that kids spend around 7.5 hours behind screens. But that's not taken into account all the multitasking. It's very often today, for example, that we work on our computers, watch television, and text at the same time. So if you take all of the multitasking with media into consideration, we're up to 11.5 hours behind screens a day. So the teenagers in our film are very much sort of the average representative of screen time. But it is, I know I'm personally very much attached to my cell phone and computer, and it's just become a huge part of our culture today that, you know, we have to kind of think about what we're missing when we are behind our screens. And I also just want to say I'm not against technology.
Right.
I'm a documentary filmmaker.
There's a little irony that you are making a film for screen about people who are addicted to screens.
Yes. We've heard that many times, especially from teenagers that are watching our film. But documentary and film, I think, is just such an important vehicle and a powerful tool to reach a large amount of people. And I love films and I love technology. I love what it's been, the positive aspects that it's done for our society. But what we are saying with the film is that, yes, there's great things with technology, but the amount of time we're spending, the amount of, you know, what kind of content it is that we're seeing, the advertising that's targeting children, all of these things are issues that we have to deal with in our society today.
One of the things that you point out in the film also is that a lot of adults, people in their 30s and 40s, are also using media as much as the children that you depict.
Yes, and that's very important for parents to think about, is how much screen time. And I think that the people that game the most, I think, are in their 30s, like mid-30s, but also, you know...
More so than teenagers.
Yes. And I, more importantly, though, I think that just for, you know, all of us, is just to kind of really think about how much time we spend in front of our screens and how we prioritize our time, especially family time with our children, because we are their role models and we are the ones that have to take responsibility for, you know, how we spend our time and how we raise our children.
We're talking to Tonya Hessen-Shea about her film Play Again, which is screening tomorrow, Wednesday, the 17th of August at 7 o'clock here in Santa Fe at Warehouse 21. So what happens to the brains of people, particularly the brains of children, that are in front of screens for that many hours a day?
That's a very interesting question. And I don't think that we fully know all the answers to what really happens with our brains and our minds. And some of the experts that we talked in the film say that, you know, we're really part of a large experiment here where we're raising a generation that is spending more time in the virtual reality than in the real world. Studies do show that repeated activity form brain patterns and that, you know, teenagers today are incredible at multitasking. And they've done studies where they have teenagers play very violent video games and afterwards show that it's harder for them to recognize emotions or facial expressions. So that's very concerning to me. I also, through working on this film and these wonderful teenagers that participated in Play Again, just to see how difficult face-to-face interactions were for them. And to be in their bodies, out in the woods, and be active was, you know, Some of them had never hiked before, never swam in a river before, or dug in the dirt before. And these kids are, you know, 13, 14, and 15 years old and growing up in Portland, Oregon.
Right.
You know, it's probably one of the greenest places in the country. So it was so interesting to see how they're fantastic at self-reflection and really talking about what screen time means to them versus being out in nature and the stress of being in a group situation. And then the loneliness for many of them too was very surprising to me, because we had a crew of around 20 people out in the woods, but in their virtual realities, they could access hundreds and hundreds of people just with a click.
And so they were lonely in a group of 20? It wasn't enough people?
Yeah, I think that, you know, they're more used to communicating through social media and through their gaming communities. And then, you know, you have your guild and your crew and your team of people that are very similar to you, that you are very connected to.
So you took these people, and there were these apparently very nice, what would you call them, sort of like camp counselors or leaders who showed them how to actually do things, how to make bows and arrows and how to start fires and how to cook in the wild and so on. How did the kids react? I mean, obviously they didn't all react the same, but what were some of the themes that came up with these young people?
Well, I think for me, in the beginning, just seeing the transition that these teenagers went through was just so impressive. And it was different for all of them. Some were just so excited to get a lot of adult attention and to be able to play with adults. And we went out with Trackers Northwest, which is a wonderful outdoors education organization in Portland. And they really let the teenagers sort of guide the activities as well, so the teens have a say in what they do. So, and I think that was empowering for most of them. And then after a couple of days without electricity and virtual reality and their communities, and especially cell phones, some of them start to kind of fall apart a little bit. That, you know, you have to see the film to experience.
I was thinking as I was watching it, there was one girl who is definitely an extreme case, but she sent, I don't even know how this is humanly possible, but she sent tens of thousands of text messages per month. Is that right?
Yes, yes. She has cut down quite a bit, but she's still up in the hundreds per day.
Hundreds per day. And her parents buy her unlimited plans.
I'm not exactly sure how they do it, but I know when we went on camp, she had two phones with her. There was no cell phone signal out there, but she is an incredible communicator virtually. And it was very interesting to see how the participation in the film changed her perspective on it, and she's now outside much more. And I just have to say, all of the teenagers are wonderful representatives of the film, and they've gone to several film festivals and won several audience awards. So they're some of our biggest supporters and representatives, and we're very, very proud of them.
So they were, I think, kind of beautifully conscious about themselves and their process and what they were going through. And there was a moment where that girl who texted 5 gazillion messages a day, or whatever it was, said, "I don't even miss my phone."
That was the first day. Yeah, that was the first day. But yeah, you know, I think that for a lot of the teenagers, and you know, just think about how traumatic it is to be a teenager in the first place, and then through the virtual world with all the benefits that it brings, with especially for the girls in the film, social media, MySpace, and Facebook are incredibly important in their lives. But they also talk a lot about, you know, the problems and the conflicts and the bullying and the stress that comes with. And I think being out in the woods, you know, made them really reflect about what it means to be away from that reality and what it means to be face to face and how you have to change your behavior. And we also, after the camp, I just have to say, we challenged them to do a screen fast. So
a screen fast.
A screen fast.
Like, don't do any screens for what, a week?
Well, it was up to them to see how long they could go. Some made it, you know, for quite a bit of time, and others refused. So but we learned a lot from that experience with them as well.
We have in Santa Fe, or we did, I don't know if it's still happening, a week-long event called Turn Off Your TV. And parents sign up and their children sign up, and the results of it are incredible. Parents and children start talking to each other over the dinner table in a way that they hadn't before, and people go outside and all kinds of things happen that don't happen when your TVs and computers are on all the time.
Yes, I love Turn Off Your TV Week, and I highly recommend that families make their own media screen fast, as you know, and fit it into and talk to your children about how that should be. I think it's important that we as adults don't just make the rules for our children's screen time. Definitely we need to set up boundaries and be role models, but I think it's very important to listen to the children, because if it's very interesting, especially if older children have to set limits for younger kids. So when we talk to the teens that were participating in Play Again about what they thought the recommended screen time should be for younger children, they were incredibly strict.
Really?
Yeah, it's, you know, 30 minutes a day, tops an hour, and you know, here they're, some of them spending 15 hours behind a screen. So and they had very good reasonings for it. So I think that, you know, children crave some kind of boundaries as well. And if we do get outside, and also here I think it's very important to get outside and listen to the children and think about what they need and not what we as adults need. Like, we don't need to go to the top of the mountain. We don't need to, you know, reach a point. The goal shouldn't be what we need. It's really being out there and finding the little wonders in nature and seeing, kind of push the kids a little bit, you know, to make it exciting, but really think about their needs.
I mean, even in residential neighborhoods in Santa Fe, there are foxes, there are skunks, there's every kind of insects, there's so many kinds of plants. Just going out in your little eighth of an acre backyard holds untold treasures.
Yes, and that's one of the very important things that we try to talk about when we travel with the film, is that I think in our culture today, you have this sort of high-tech perception of that you need all this equipment to go outside and you need to go into the wilderness, but nature is really all around us. And we just have to get out there and kind of stop and look around.
We're talking to Tanya Hessen-Shea about the film Play Again. What are some of the ways that children learn better outdoors from nature than indoors from games and screens?
Oh, that is a great question. And it's unlimited answers, I think. Personally, I think one of the big challenges we have today when we bring children outside is that so many of their experiences with nature has happened through the virtual world or television and exciting nature programs where they see, you know, the deathly catch of the lion chasing, you know, the deer and the kill, and things happen very fast in these nature films, and then they come outside and they don't see the moose or they don't see the action, and so often get very disappointed and bored. And I think we have to sort of figure out, you know, how we can reconnect our children and how we can relearn how to be outside with our children.
And the patience and the completely different time scale.
Yes.
That you're implying.
Yeah, you know, nature really needs time. Like David Suzuki says in our film, like, nature needs time to reveal her secrets. And time is something that we have such a hard time finding in our society today. And I know that for sure with myself and my children too. You know, it really has to be something that we prioritize. To get outside and to turn off our phones and to make sort of a sacred family time. And it's not easy, and it's something that I'm working with constantly. Yeah. And my children now call me out on it, and they're like, "You made this film about this, Mama, come on." So, you know, we have to remind ourselves, and we have to make this an important priority in our lives, I believe.
There's a beautiful quotation from Bill McKibben, who is in the film briefly, who talks about how when you're in a video game, you were in the center, and when you're watching TV, it's all about the, it's a kid's show, it's all about that little kid, and the kid is the center of the universe. And when you're in nature, you learn in a very visceral way that you're not the center of the universe. You're one very small part in a really big web of life, and you don't matter in that same way. And it seems like a, he didn't say it in these ways, but it seems like a kind of letting go of ego and giving yourself over to the bigger community.
Yes, I love that quote too, and I, it's something I think it's so important today for all of us, you know, when we're outside to really to sense that connection. And to, I mean, for me personally, when I go outside, life makes more sense. The stress disappears and, you know, you realize that you're part of something so much bigger. And also just, you know, mentally, like, what does it do to your soul? I mean, for me, that is the closest I get to, you know, church. It's being in awe and seeing the wonder and, yeah, and the freedom that it comes with not being in the center of everything.
There's also, and I think that this is one of the many interesting things about the film Play Again, was the kind of creativity that children exhibit when they're outside, when they're in nature, when they're playing outdoors, when they're playing with each other, is vastly greater than the scope for creativity within a game.
Yeah, I think this is one of the saddest things to me is just seeing how free play is disappearing from childhood today. Recess is disappearing from schools. When we released the film, they were just starting a program of recess coaches around the country.
No.
Yes, 18,000 recess coaches being spread around the country to go out to schools just to teach children how to play. Because all around the country, teachers were complaining that children were so bored at recess and there was so much bullying and fighting that they didn't have enough resources to be outside with the kids. And also, you know, you have the No Child Left Behind that has put so much pressure on the testing. So, you know, it's just so important to keep in mind how, what kind of role free play has for children. And with them spending so much time with media, you see all this media saturated play where they're just imitating the stories that they're being told by the media and by the films that they're watching. And that's a very interesting thing. Like when we were growing up, we were also watching movies, but we would maybe see a film once, maybe twice. But today, you know, you own the DVD, often comes with all kinds of toys and accessories and books and bedding, pajamas,
right.
Cups, you know,
merchandise.
I mean, they're so saturated and completely bombarded by these stories all the time. So it was when we were working on the film, we went out on this nature camp actually with my children's school, and I was filming the kids playing, and it looked like they were having, you know, a great time. And then I as I got closer into it, I was realizing that they were playing a scene from a film. And they were arguing about what the line of the film was. So, and the people I couldn't remember the line of the film sort of fell on the outside of the game. So, I mean, it's just the, you know, the contrast to that with children just being out there creating their own stories.
Right.
And I think it's so important for us today to give our time, our children time for silence and just to be sort of in their own space.
I think the other subtext of the film, which is really important to talk about, was that a lot of this marketing to children and marketing of games to children and so on is basically about turning them into consumers, turning them into little people who crave stuff. And when you're out in nature, that craving goes away. You don't crave stuff anymore. You might crave a warm sweater if it gets cold, but that's about it.
Yes, I think it's very important for our children to get away from the consumerism and the commercialization that they are being targeted with today. It is really intense, the whole industry that is built up around targeting children with advertisements.
Billions spent on this.
Billions, and psychologists are studying children from they're born and branding children and figuring out, you know, different levels of whining to get to their parents. So and they're
figuring out how to get kids to wine.
Yes, so that parents will give in.
Right.
And I think it really shows how far we've come in our society when we allow corporations to act that way towards our children.
Well, there's this sense that I had during the film that, in a way, one can see one's country being destroyed from within.
Yeah, John Young, one of the experts in the film, he talks about how, you know, we're so worried about all these external enemies in the country today, but we really don't think about what's happening internally. And as he's saying, you know, as we're cutting our children off from the basics, what is going to happen? You know, how are these children? And there's this other quote that goes really well with this, where Charles Jordan says, "What they do not know, they will not value, and what they will not value, they will lose."
Yeah.
Because they will not protect it.
Well, if you don't know nature, then you don't care about it enough to protect it, and without nature, game over,
yeah.
So to speak.
Yes, that's why we need to play again.
Yeah.
But I do think it's you know, we are working so hard on many different levels today to fight global warming and climate change. And I think that in that process, it's so important that we don't forget our children, because that they are our future. And I really believe it is our responsibility, and it has to be looked upon as an environmental issue and an environmental problem to reconnect our children to nature.
So the film is called Play Again. It's screening tomorrow, Wednesday, the 17th of August at 7 o'clock at Warehouse 21. It's co-presented by Bioneers. Now, you've followed, and at the end there's a little bit about the young people who were in the film. They were all sort of 13, 14 years of age when the film was made. And what interested me was some of them really didn't continue to go out into nature and go camping or hiking and things like that, but got more into, for example, dance and theater.
Oh, they are so creative and have so much going for them. And actually, like, you know, we really, really never believed that just a short week out in nature would really make a huge impact.
It was only a week?
It was only a week. But, you know, what is really important here is just to look at what that little time did for them as a group and as individuals. And even though it didn't change them right away, I think now, because we've been staying in touch and we're, for example, Facebook friends with most of them, and they do come out and speak at the film. And some of them have changed, you know, their career plans and have gotten a much deeper perspective on it and are kind of the ones that are pushing their families to make changes in their lives.
Tonya Hessen-Shea is director of the award-winning documentary Play Again. We will see you at Warehouse 21 tomorrow night at 7 o'clock.
I hope so. I look forward to it.
Thanks for being with us on the Radio Cafe. I'm very happy now to welcome to the program Doug Heller and Bobby Valentine. Their new book is called Aloft at the Albuquerque International Balloon Fiesta. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
So you are doing a book signing and a whole event about the book this coming weekend. We'll talk about that in a moment, but let's first talk about hot air balloons. This is a very interesting book. It's not only about the balloon fiesta, but it's about these crazy contraptions. I mean, the idea that somebody thought of wanting to go up into the air in a basket, how did it happen?
Well, it all started in France in 1700s when two brothers working in a paper factory noticed with some fire burning that the paper rose over the top of the fire, and they weren't sure why this was happening. At first, they believed that it was the Montpellier gas, which it was called, not the heat from the hot air. And they decided to test this theory and conceived a paper bag, and in French that was called a ballon, and that's where the name balloon comes from. And they kept on experimenting until they got to the point where they constructed a very large balloon contraption and got approval from the King of France to actually fly that. And the first flight actually involved animals, not humans.
Right.
And
what was it, a duck, a rooster, and a goat or something?
Yes, yes. And they successfully launched, and that's how it all got its beginning. And it kind of grew from there. The sport really lingered it really didn't become a sport until they found a way to take compressed propane and was able to heat that. And that really didn't occur until the 50s. And that's when ballooning really took off as a sport, because now they had a way to heat this air. Heated air is lighter than cold air, and that's what gives the balloons the lift. And the sport really took off from there.
Even in the 18th and 19th centuries, you had people going up to the stratosphere, literally the stratosphere, in these balloons that they made. Which is, first of all, it's extraordinary. I mean, it's the highest that anybody had ever gone. And it's, I mean, how could they breathe? We go up to 18,000 feet and can barely breathe.
Right, and that was clearly a problem in the early years, and I think some people lost their lives in the process. But there is a race that continues every year that is a distance race, taking the longest distance in a balloon that you can travel. There is no navigational system, but early on, it was how high you could fly. And now that we have airplanes and rockets to take us into outer space, ballooning is now a distance race sport.
Now, how does that actually work? Can you control the... I can see how maybe you can control the vertical motion of a balloon through controlling the hot air, but how do you control the horizontal movement? Are you not just at the mercy of the winds?
Yes, it's airflow. So depending on the altitude, the winds change direction, and that's what they rely on. So although there's no navigational control in the sense of an aeroplane, there is some control. They do know which direction they're going, obviously. They know the speed they're going. And they go up and down to chase the wind direction.
So they know which way the wind currents are going and just basically ride that wave.
Correct. Which is how the pilots play with the box effect in Albuquerque, going up and down into different streams of air. And they get forced one way, and then they either go higher or lower, get a different air current, and it pushes them the other direction.
And so they eventually make a rectangle.
Yes, and they come back around. So they're in a perfect condition. They can take off from the field and go back to the field.
So let's talk about the Albuquerque Balloon Fiesta. How did that begin and when?
Well, it actually began with Sid Cutter. Cutter Aviation is still in existence today. But Sid, in 1971, right, was having a birthday party for his mother. And he wanted to do something extra special for this birthday party. So he asked a friend if they would inflate a balloon. And because that was very extraordinary at the time, and they inflated a balloon, this kind of made news. About that same time, I believe it was 1972, KOB Radio was having an anniversary, and they wanted to do something special for the anniversary. I think at that point in time, the largest gathering of balloons had been about 13. And Tom Rutherford from KOB collaborated with Sid Cutter, and they said, why don't we do something special for our anniversary and see if we can beat that record and get a larger gathering of balloons? And so that was their goal for the anniversary. That first mass ascension occurred from the Coronado parking lot, made the news, and Balloon Fiesta just grew and grew from there. It reached its peak with, I think, 1,019 balloons. Clearly, the largest gathering of balloons in the world, and it, I think it still maintains that record of being the largest gathering of balloons of any ballooning event throughout the world. And that number has since been reduced because over the years, Albuquerque has actually grown in population. And as it's grown in population, there's fewer and fewer places to land. So,
oh my goodness!
The board decided it was wise and prudent to actually reduce the number of balloons that they would allow, and I think that number stands at five
600.
Yeah, no more than 600.
Talk about the evolution of creative balloon designs. I mean, there's some crazy stuff. There are cathedrals flying in the air, there's animals, there's...
It started with advertising. And the advertisers wanted something different, so they started talking to the balloon manufacturers about doing balloons that would help them advertise whatever their product was. And so the early days were just variations on the teardrop shape. And then you could get, you know, there's a flying Alpo dog food we've seen over the years, and Pepsi and so forth. And then it became really crazy as technology allowed them to design using basically an architectural CAD system, not unlike designing a building. They were able to come up with things like the St. Gallen Cathedral that we feature in the book, which is an astonishing thing to see flying. Yeah. The overall designs vary. There's only a few companies that do the intricate
special
shapes. And they're very, very well known for them. And, of course, the favorites down at Balloon Fiesta are Arabelle, the Creamland cow.
Right.
And the joke is always when it's flying over the field low, it's close encounters of the udder kind.
Oof.
And the bees. The bees are, you know when the bees are about to take off, you can hear the whole field erupt in applause and cheers. It's definitely an audience favorite. But there's some other great ones, and you really, when you understand how they're made, you kind of wonder how they're actually able to get off the ground. I mean, some of them are so slab-sided that the minute there's a slight breeze, it's pretty difficult to get them off the ground, like SpongeBob, the Sunny Boy, which is the beautiful the full sun with the little rays coming off him.
Yeah.
And there's a few others like that. And
Wells Fargo.
And Wells Fargo, of course, the stagecoach.
They take an enormous amount of time to inflate. They take a huge crew because of the size to control the balloon, why it's inflating. They weigh a lot, so just packing them up, you know, once you do inflate it, and if you're lucky enough to take off, once you land, it takes a huge crew to pack all the envelope up and the basket. But they are a favorite of Balloon Fiesta and the crowd, and you don't get the same special shapes down there every year. Some of them come in internationally, so it's always a surprise what special shapes are going to show up for the Balloon Fiesta and whether or not they're going to be able to actually fly.
What weather conditions are necessary for them to take off?
Well,
low wind.
Yeah, low wind. I mean, the early Balloon Fiesta occurred in April. It was later determined that the calmest winds and coolest weather conditions were in October. And eventually Balloon Fiesta was moved to October for that reason. Because you want, again, related to the box condition, which only occurs in very few places throughout the world, you need that cool, very cool morning air and very calm winds.
And so that's why the mass ascension is so very, very, very early in the morning.
Correct.
Correct, because the winds pick up, the heat also is a factor, and so that's why ballooning is a very early morning sport. We call it the ugly hour.
We're talking to Doug Heller and Bobby Valentine about their new book, Aloft at the Albuquerque International Balloon Fiesta. What are some of the safety precautions that people have to take when they get involved in ballooning?
Well, first off, you can't just go buy a balloon and inflate it and start flying. You actually have to be fully accredited with the FAA as if you were a pilot of a small fixed-wing plane. So people don't realize that there's a fair amount that goes into that before you even can take off. The pilots that we have flown with over the years are pretty amazing when they go through their pre-flight check, their safety, the checklists with us as the passengers. We, the passengers, become part of the team for watching what's going on above and below us. So we become additional eyes. And so you don't take it for granted. And I think because of the way the pilots take this so seriously is why this is actually a pretty safe sport in the scheme of things. You know, we talk to people, they go, we'd never go up in a balloon. I personally would not jump out of a plane with a sheet on my back. But I have no problem flying in a balloon because of what it goes into the overall process.
Right. I've never, in all the many years that I've, decades that I've lived here in New Mexico, I've never been to one of the mass ascensions. Everybody's seen pictures of them. It must be extraordinary to be on the ground watching these balloons go up.
It is.
It's hard to explain. There's an energy level. People, there is large crowds, but we've gone for years. Everyone is so well behaved. It's one of the few balloon events in the world where you actually can be on the launch field next to the balloon when it goes aloft. That's very unusual. And that's one of the reasons it's the most photographed event in the world. But hearing the sound of the burners ignite, and there is the Zebra crew who's responsible for controlling the crowd, and the actual launch of balloons, which go off the field in waves. And it's, you know, the back of our book, there's a statement that says, ballooning and airborne addiction. And we've met people down that have been involved with Balloon Fiesta for over 30 years. It is addicting. It's addicting being there, and it must, for pilots, it must be addicting to be a pilot and fly. Each flight is a new venture. You don't know what direction you're going to go, where you're going to land. It tests your skills, but it's great fun and great adrenaline, great excitement.
And there is the racing component of it. There's the exhibition component of it. And the racing balloons, they're super aerodynamic and not decorative at all.
Called football shape. And they are more aerodynamic than the standard balloon. It gives them an advantage with the wind and controlling the speed and direction that they go. You do see some of these taking place in the competition. But there's also special shapes
that compete, yeah, which is really interesting. Because when I flew last year, I was in a regular shape balloon, but Pepsi Can was flying right next to us trying to win the prize. So it was interesting to see him, and Hamlet, the flying pink pig that everybody loves, he was flying as well. So some of the special shapes do compete. The America's Challenge is actually gas balloons, not hot air, and so it's a whole different thing. They typically take off late in the day, early evening, and they're the ones that are trying to go the distance, and that's a totally different component to Balloon Fiesta than the hot air balloons. And we do touch on that in the book because it is an important component, and it ties into an international race called the Gordon Bennett.
We're talking about the book Aloft by Bobby Valentine and Doug Heller. So how did you come to write this book? Which is, of course, I mean, right, it's also full of amazing pictures.
Well, it all started with the pictures. We had been fortunate enough to be attending Balloon Fiesta for over 5 years and going down as press through our film distribution business. And so Bobby and I were afforded the opportunity during mass ascension to each fly with pilots and get some amazing photographs. And that's a rare treat because not that many people go up during balloon fiesta and mass ascension. So we had all these great images, and we were sitting around one day, and we go, God, we've got all these great images. Maybe we ought to think about doing a book. And we did some research and found that there wasn't a lot on ballooning in general. And we looked at the books that had been done in the past of Balloon Fiesta, and we felt that there was some things that we could add to that experience that were not in the previous publications. So we pitched Balloon Fiesta that we have an idea for a book, and we kind of storyboarded what we wanted in it. And we cover the history of ballooning, and we cover all of the 9-day events of Balloon Fiesta. And we also covered ballooning nomenclature, how they're made, how do they fly, how much do they cost, what are the pilot requirements.
How much do they cost?
Well, I mean, they can range from $40,000 to $45,000 and up into over a couple of $100,000 for when you get into the special shapes.
So it's not only addiction, but it's a pricey addiction.
Oh,
it is.
So.
It is a pricey addiction.
Yes. Yes.
No question about it. But we wanted to put a book together that inquiring minds wanted to know, and we felt that that would be a great souvenir for people to take away and enrich their ballooning experience.
Over the years, when we'd been on the field and also talking to friends after we'd been down to Balloon Fiesta, we kept hearing people ask, gee, I wish I knew more, or a little kid asking his parent, what makes it go up?
Right.
So there is this need for a little more to know of what they're seeing, not just the incredible experience. And so we figured that needed to be included in the book. And the compliments we've been getting on that, the Balloon Museum was one that commented that they really appreciated the fact that was in there, because they do get people wanting to know a little bit without being like a textbook.
So then they can say, here, read the book.
Yeah, and it's got pictures pointing to the different parts. And so it's easy for anybody of any age to understand the basics of what makes up a balloon.
Exactly. So you are having an event this weekend, Saturday the 20th of August, in the garden courtyard of La Posada Hotel here in Santa Fe from 2 to 6 in the afternoon to introduce the book and just to have fun.
Correct. Yes. Right. We're doing that in conjunction with Santa Fe Friends of Jazz and New Mexico Glass Alliance and La Posada Hotel itself. And we have Steve Stucker coming up for a couple hours from 4 to 6. We've got the John Trentacosta Trio playing from 4 to 6. And we've got a champagne tasting. It's going to be a good break from Indian Market for the afternoon to have people come and do something before they rest up and go out to dinner.
For more information, the website is aloftbooks.com. And you can find out more about the book and the event, and you can view the book as well.
Yes, we have a flip book loaded on there. So there's a place that says view the book, and you can take a preview, and then there's a place to order.
Excellent.
So it's very easy.
The book is called Aloft at the Albuquerque International Balloon Fiesta. Doug Heller and Bobby Valentine, thanks for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thanks
for having us.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to .foil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe, and my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, then local news, then jazz.